In this, the final lecture of this series, I intend to do the following. One is I intend to complete, to begin with, the stepping through the spherical evolution chapter, the end of chapter 7 in the book. Then it is my intention to sort of corroborate this, as it were, by giving you a practical demo of an evolving Plummer model. Effectively, basically, we will be going back to what we already did as a demonstration all the way at the beginning of this lecture series, except now that I hope you will be looking at this with different eyes, having learned in the course of these weeks what to look for in the effects of stellar dynamics. Let us go back then for the moment to section 7.5 in the book, that is to say, the evolution of spherical stellar systems. It so happens that the algebraic part of this chapter leans relatively heavily on the Fokker-Planck approximation, which we discussed in this lecture series only in a superficial way. Of course, that is unavoidable because the Fokker-Planck approximation and its consequences could easily form the subject of an entire lecture series, and therefore it would be rather top-heavy to expend too much attention on this. Therefore, some of the things that I will present to you today and that are presented in this chapter in the book will look, to a certain extent, somewhat enigmatic. I will try, however, to give you an overview over the background of this particular sort of physics. So starting then on page 596, we see there the way in which it is computed what the diffusion properties are of the stars. I already mentioned to you that when we look at the original collisionless Boltzmann equation, which will read like this. In a scalar notation, of course, you know that V, X, and A are vectors, but just for clarity, let's write it this way, that if on the left-hand side there is a collision term, that of necessity leads to a redistribution of particles in phase space, and that redistribution can be expressed in various ways. One of the more profitable ways is to look upon this as a diffusion process. So from this, it follows a diffusion process, and that is something that I think you can readily understand by again referring to the analogy with gas dynamics, fluid dynamics, thermodynamics, and so on and so forth. I mean, consider that you had a gas, like in this room or in an atmosphere, with absolute zero temperature. That means that the only velocities there are systematic velocities, so they're streaming all over. If then you add a certain amount of randomness to this, in other words, you introduce a finite temperature, that means that if you move with the wind in a parcel of gas, you will find that there is a velocity distribution with respect to the point with which you are moving. That, of course, due to the collisions between the various particles in that chunk of gas that you are following, due to those collisions, there will be a redistribution of particles. That is to say, even if you were to take a cell moving with the gas, then not all the particles will be retained in that cell forever, but due to random motions and bumps and lumps, they will be slowly drifting in and out of this particular box, and that is a diffusion process. You can then relatively straightforwardly understand that computing the diffusion properties, that is to say, diffusion constants, or in the case of a liquid, which you would call viscosity, is a matter of studying the distribution function, not on a large scale, but on a small scale. That is to say, the subgrid model that we had been talking about all the time. In the case of the Fokker-Planck approximation, the one that we use here in chapter 7.5, that diffusion takes a shape that we have already discussed previously, but let me remind you of this again. You had a velocity versus position. Then, if there is no random motions, you simply have trajectories like this of the phase points. If there are interactions, then either you have interaction at one exact point when you have head-on collisions, like in the case of a gas or a liquid, that is the Boltzmann approximation that we cannot use in the case of stars, because stars do not physically collide, and their range of interaction, being gravitational, is effectively infinite. But rather, we had a situation in which a transition from one phase orbit to another phase orbit is kind of slow and relatively small. And because of energy conservation, of course, if the interaction goes up, it means that you go up in velocity space in one trajectory, there must be another trajectory that goes down in velocity space, right? So energy conservation effectively leads to what you might call a repulsion in velocity space. It looks kind of funny, but it is the way it is. That means then that these particles end up on positions in phase space where they were not without this interaction, and the extent to which this spread occurs then, the extent to which this spread occurs is expressed in a constant or a function in general, but it might be a constant in ideal cases, which you call a diffusion constant. The trick in the Fokker-Planck approximation is that when you compute this diffusion, you will see that it is related to a correlation between all velocity components in all directions and their possible derivatives, and that means that you have to stop this somehow, this computation, because otherwise you get a change of a change of a change of a change of a change. And cutting off this expansion sequence at a particular location, at a particular order of expansion, is what is behind the Fokker-Planck approximation. So this being said verbally, you will note, those of you who have a stomach for these things and have an interest in this can look back to, I think it's chapter 4, where this Fokker-Planck approximation is explained in detail. But this may suffice for basically understanding the mechanism. Why is this mechanism important in all galaxies, and how can we use it in the case of spherical galaxies, the ones that we're focusing on at this particular point? That is effectively addressed in section 7.5.2 on the theme of evaporation and ejection. The idea being the following, that if you take a single star in a stellar system and you follow its fate. Now, this, of course, is somewhat contrary to the spirit of the velocity distribution over here, where you talk about a general behavior and the overall behavior of a large number of stars in a given phase cell. But let that pass for the moment. If you follow the fate of an individual star, then you effectively have two extremes, two extreme alternatives. For reasons that we will be talking about in an instant, and that we had in fact anticipated during the first few lectures when I did the numerical demos, the center of a stellar system tends to contract and contract and contract, sometimes even catastrophically, an effect that is known as core collapse that we will discuss in a moment. For the stars in the periphery of such a galaxy then, that means that if they move on, shall we say, pseudo-Keplerian orbit, right? I mean, if they're very far away from the mass concentration here, by and large, it is not a bad bet to think that it is sort of like on an elliptical orbit. When they venture into this central region over here, then basically two things can happen. One alternative is that when going in, such a star may encounter another star that is part of this core over here. They will interact. They're both on a hyperbolic orbit with respect to one another. And, of course, you know that in a hyperbolic orbit in the center of mass system, the outstate is the same as the instate, right? Because of energy, momentum, and angular momentum conservation. If I have one star coming in like this and another star coming in like that, and they interact on a hyperbolic orbit, then the only thing that has changed when this star goes out here is the direction of its final velocity, but the magnitude is going to be the same, and similarly over here. However, because of the random motions in the center of such a system here, the center of mass of such a system is not necessarily at rest with respect to the center of mass of the system as a whole, which means that even though after the interaction, this incoming halo star may in the center of mass system have the same magnitude of the velocity that it had to begin with, it need not do so when you transform back to the center of mass system of the galaxy as a whole, which means that there is a finite possibility of this star to be ejected from the system altogether. It is that process that is called ejection by the authors here, and they make a reasonable estimate as to what the magnitude of that ejection is. Basically, it's really not too hard to understand the equation, except the numerical factor is something that you have to do a lot of work in. So let us look at the equation 7137. The rate of change, so the dN, change of the total amount of particles here, is negative because there's an escape. Of course, it still needs some explanation why there is an escape at all, right? But we touched on this before, and I'll come back to it in a moment. Will be proportional to some sort of constant times the total number of particles. That's obvious because there are so many more particles that this could happen to, right? So just simply a matter of independent statistics. Times the time step over which the interaction occurs, divided by some characteristic time, time scale of the system as a whole. And, of course, again, they take the relaxation time scale for this that we had discussed before. I think it was two lectures ago. Which means then that you get a dN by dt here, so a time rate of change of the total density over which it's simply proportional to n over t. So this would be an exponential effect. Whether or not it is important in the course of the evolution of a stellar system depends on two things. It depends on the relaxation time, and it depends on this numerical factor of this constant over here. Now, we had already seen that for large stellar systems, the relaxation time is a large number times the crossing time. Right? So for practical purposes, this could easily exceed the age of the universe. Given also that when you do your sums properly, it turns out that this factor is small. It is mentioned in the book as something of the order of 10 to the minus 3 or thereabouts, and why it is precisely that number, you would just simply have to compute. You will see that this ejection effect is, in fact, exceedingly rare. Right? So for practical purposes, we do not really have to worry about it overly much. There is, however, another mechanism. So this is one that we have. There is another mechanism, and that is the following. If you follow the orbit of such a star through the center part of the stellar system, there may not be very many hard encounters of this type, but there may be many, many soft encounters. That is to say, rather than if you had a potential well over here, rather than this star following some sort of orbit of... Sorry, I'm doing this wrong. Rather than this star following an orbit of this type, just a smooth orbit in a smooth potential, if you were to take a magnifying glass and look on a small section of such an orbit, you see that it will wiggle a little bit. It just goes by one star, or maybe a group of stars, etc., 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 and just sort of meanders around like this. Now, two things bear thinking about here. To begin with, you may want to compute, in a case like this, what the sort of flowing with respect to the average orbit is here, on the assumption that this is caused by the proximity of individual stars that deflect the orbit that otherwise would have been smooth. Right. Now, the thing to consider here is that, yes, you can in fact think about this, but you must not ignore the effects of Poisson statistics. Right. If you were to distribute points at random, and I have given a very bad example of this here because to humans it is exceedingly difficult to just simply by eye reproduce a truly random system, you will find that not only do you have single stars, but you have groups of stars just purely due to small number statistics. And then, of course, it could well be that you scatter off not a single star, but of a group of five stars, which means that this particular excursion is going to be considerably bigger than you thought it was originally. That being said, these slow drifting with respect to an average guiding orbit over here is, of course, very reminiscent of what I mentioned over here. That is the whole setup of the Fokker-Planck approximation. Just a little bump in one direction and a little bump of the bumped star in another direction. So this process then amounts to a random motion in phase space, and I think you already begin to see from this introduction what this would mean for the escape probability of an individual star. If you think of this as a diffusion in energy space, you will see that every now and then such a soft encounter will increase the energy of the passing star, but then again it is also possible that it will decrease the energy. So if you have a delta E, which for a given density distribution would be sort of constant, then if you have a certain probability that you get a delta E, then you will see that the probability of getting positive contributions to energy again and again and again and again and again, it is simply a matter of multiplying the individual probabilities, and therefore the probability is relatively small. And consequently, you would expect that the escape probability would be an exponential or something of the order of delta E over some sort of fiducial energy over there. Now, that could be a relatively small number, could be a relatively large number. It doesn't really matter too much. You would have to do your sums in that particular case. Now, one thing I want to point out, because it is emphasized in the book, is what is at the bottom of page 603. One thing you might consider is saying, well, I'm not really interested in these individual encounters here. I'll just simply say that this orbit will spread to a certain extent, and all I will compute is the average spread with respect to the unperturbed orbit that it had originally. It turns out that that is not the case. You cannot do it properly. And I want to warn you about this because it is one case in which it is clear when you do the numbers that you have to be exceedingly careful to include the graininess, the point distribution of the stars inside this system. You cannot, with impunity, just simply take, just take your fingers and just wipe this out into some sort of continuum and then say, I'm going to consider the motion of the stars in this smoothed out potential. You cannot necessarily do that. Sometimes you can, sometimes you cannot. The way in which this is done is rather clever. It is in equation 7139, which I will copy from the book straight away. And that is the following. The time rate of change of the energy when you follow a star on this smooth orbit here is proportional to the binding energy which is negative, of course, so this is a positive number, to the 3 horsepower. Again, that 3 horsepower we encountered approximately halfway through the lecture series when we talked about the spherical Poisson law and how it could possibly solve itself consistently. It is, of course, related, as you can see from this 3 horsepower, to what we know as Kepler's third law in the case of point mechanics. Straight away, you can solve this differential equation, which sort of barring what the prefactor is over here. And that means that the energy that you get is some sort of constant, initial energy, divided by the following quantity, 1 plus some sort of constant times the time, all squared. It's really funny that this should happen. And the interesting thing about this is that you can unbind this star, which means that its total energy is zero, because all the way at infinity when it has escaped from the potential well and it has zero velocity at infinity, so that E equals zero, only when T equals infinite. All right? So you can show here straight away that if this were the case, if you only look at the smooth motion of stars, then you have to wait forever, literally, before the stellar system would evaporate. So this is definitely wrong. The correct form is then given in 7141, which is done by following these little wiggles and squiggles, computing the appropriate diffusion properties, and then say, well, in the fullness of time, some stars will diffuse away from the center because there will be some lucky ones or unlucky ones, depending on your point of view, that get bumped again and again and again and again and again with the same energy distribution, with the same energy jump, sorry, and therefore can end up unbound. Again, that the equation one ends up with, not very surprisingly, has exactly the same form as the one over here, except with a slightly different timescale and a slightly different prefactor. Right. So when you do the sums properly, you will find that the relaxation rate of such a system is very long, very long relaxation timescale. And therefore, this evaporation under ordinary circumstances, again, is relatively slow. Right? We're talking here about a prefactor here, which is something of the order of, shall we say, 300 or 400 relaxation timescales. And that is just plain simply longer than the age of the universe, except for a few percent, maybe 5 or 10% of the stars that may evaporate. There is then another mechanism that turns out to be one of the two driving forces, driving mechanisms, I should say, for the long-term evolution of stellar systems. And in the case of spherical systems, it is not too frightfully hard to compute it. And that is relatively easily explained when we look again at the distribution of stars in the center of such a system. So let me copy that from this drawing over here. And I'm going to ask myself, for a generic system of this sort, which is centrally concentrated, and for the moment, again, we're just discussing this, we will think about a spherical system. We know that if we were to draw a section through this system in the center over here, and we were to try and plot the potential, then that potential will generally have a generic shape of the following kind. At infinity, it sort of flattens out asymptotically to zero, and in the core, it descends very steeply in some sort of potential well over here. You may well ask yourself, why have I not drawn a singularity over here? Right, I might well I've continued this all the way to zero. Well, for the very obvious reason that if this were so, I would require that the stellar density is infinite at the center, which means that effects that we have ignored, such as stellar tidal encounters or even worse, physical stellar collisions, must be taken into account. Right. Another alternative is that we might have a supermassive black hole in the center of such a system, but I have already mentioned to you previously that we pointedly exclude this case because it is rather different from the stellar dynamics that we're discussing here. Now let us consider whether or not we can get some intuitive feel as to what a system like this is going to do in the long run. When doing this, and you look at that sort of figure, it is not too hard to imagine that it is in fact composed of two extreme parts. One, which is a parabolic function fitted to the center over here, added to a function that tangents over here, and that goes all the way to the negative infinity. It is these two extremes that we can consider. So here we have a system with a parabolic dependence of the potential, and that corresponds, of course, to the case of a constant mass density or a constant mass in general. So we have then a case here where the density is a constant. Consequently, if you simply do your numbers, you will find that the mass in the center over here is proportional to the cube of the radius. And you will also find that the circular velocity, which is an indication of the circular of the velocity altogether, is proportional to the radius. So it's solid body rotation. Right. Now let us consider the other alternatives. The other alternative, namely this one here, which is effectively a Keplerian potential, a point mass potential all the way on the outside. In this case, we have a situation where the mass is a constant, that is perceived over here, which means that the average density is proportional to the r to the minus 3. That in turn means that the circular velocity is proportional to r to the minus 1/2, which is, of course, Kepler's third law, which you'll remember over here. And not to be neglected, what can we expect about the random motions? Well, there, in order to get an idea about that, we hark back to the Scalar-Viriel theorem. And the Scalar-Viriel theorem tells us that in a case like this, the temperature will be proportional to V squared, so proportional to R squared, and here the temperature will be proportional to R to the minus 1. So, and with this temperature, of course, I mean just a measure of the random velocities of the stars. We also want to call it, in terms of sigma, the velocity dispersion. Velocity dispersion in those cases is by and large anisotropic, but that is a slight detail. Just for completeness, let me mention that in a case like this, when you have a harmonic potential in the center, the velocity dispersion of the stars is isotropic by and large, and in a spherical system it certainly is, whereas when you go further and further out, the velocity dispersion is anisotropic. Most orbits are radial or practically radial, right? So the transverse motions there, the circular motions, are technically speaking go like r to the minus 1/2, but there isn't very much in the way of circular motion there. Most of the motions are radial. Well then, from that dichotomy of splitting up this galaxy in a core part, all right, like a core part over here and a halo part over there, you can already see that there must be some sort of transition between the two. Of course, the sum of these functions I've given here isn't really what you want. Right? It is, they have to be glued together in some way so that net they follow this white line over here that we started with. But you get my drift. There is a certain point, and let us see if we can indicate approximately where that must be. There is a certain inflection point here, shall we say, beyond which you can say that there is a transition from one type of potential, that is the core potential, to the halo potential further out. Now, the thing to consider is that there is something like a timescale also involved with this. So the corresponding dynamical timescale of a system of this sort goes like that, that it is approximately equal to 1 over the square root of the gravitational constant type times the density. Okay, that's something that you absolutely have to memorize. I mean, it's one of the most useful equations in astrophysics. That means then that if we were to apply that over here, that the dynamical time scale equals 1 over square root g rho, and rho goes like r to the minus 3, and therefore this time scale goes as the plus 3 halves power, which is Kepler's third law. Right. Over here, however, you will see that if somehow the mass density were to increase, the corresponding dynamical timescale would decrease, which means that the mechanism that caused the density to increase will act more quickly, which means that the timescale would become shorter again, etc., 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 etc. So there will be a runaway effect in the center over here that will cause this particular potential bottom to get deeper in a catastrophic way, right? Very, very suddenly. This is known as core collapse, and just simply from looking at the dimensional quantities over here, you can already guess what the effect is going to be. Now, due to energy conservation, of course, this cannot just simply happen by itself. There must be a redistribution of energy. From the scalar virial theorem, we already know that if this potential well gets a deeper bottom, then, of course, the random motions of the star, the temperature, if you will, must also increase. Right? So a certain amount of the energy that is gained by making this core collapse will go into making the stars in the core go faster. At the same time, however, because there is a gravitational interaction between the outside and inside, that means that this hot central core will blow up the outer parts and will effectively decrease its temperature. So a situation that we then get is if you start with a stellar system that is mildly concentrated, it will go through this phase of core collapse when you get a hotter and more compact core, and you get a cooler, in a dynamical sense, cooler envelope. Those of you who followed stellar structure and stellar evolution will, of course, know an analogy of this, which is the formation of a red giant star, where the core of a star contracts and the envelope of the star swells up. Even though the detailed redistribution mechanism is different in both cases, I mean, in the case of a star, there's physical collisions between the stellar atoms, and in the case of a stellar system, it is the overall dynamics in phase space. Still, because we have a self-gravitating system, this analogy is to a certain extent correct. The analogy goes even further. You know from stellar evolution that the timescale for evolving away from an ordinary star to a red giant star is very short compared with the overall lifetime on the main sequence of a star. In part, of course, this is due to the internal effects of the star, such as nuclear fusion. But even so, the difference in timescale is reflected in the timescale of this core collapse over here, which can be very, very short indeed. That being said, one would actually have to do the numbers in order to see what comes out in detail. On page 537, there is in fact a result of a computation that has been done. This is 537, I think. No, 557. I have to look it up in the book just a moment. They're referring to it here. But, bear with me for a moment. Yes. Sorry. The figure that I wanted to refer to is on page 594 of the book, which is figure 7.4. There, one shows quite clearly what the radius of a system is compared with the time. And I'm just going to copy this for a moment on the blackboard. Figure goes as follows. Time progresses in this direction over here, and this axis is the logarithm, in this particular case, of the radius of a subsystem. And with the radius of a subsystem, I mean the radius within which a given fraction of the mass is contained. Right. Just copying again, it's 0.01 over here, 0.1. 1.0. What one sees is that up here, the paths go in this direction. There is a certain path in between here, which is more or less horizontal. And then there is another path over here, which does this. Right. The marker on the bottom path here is 0.01, so this is 1% of the mass of the total system. And on the top here, it is 0.9. Okay, so 90% of the mass is included in here. And this horizontal bit over here is approximately 0.4. So what we see here, and this is just the result of an exact computation of what happens in such a system, is that a shell containing 40% of the mass of the stellar system stays put in the course of time. A shell containing 90% of the mass, which is further out, slowly expands in the course of time. And then a shell containing just a few percent of the mass of the system collapses and would, in fact, run away all the way to infinite density if we were to let it. I mean, this, of course, is a theoretical computation that does not take small-scale effects like stellar collisions into account, but you get the idea. It is exceedingly difficult to compute exactly what this time is from first principles. It depends on initial conditions. It depends in detail on the stellar velocity distribution. And, of course, it depends on the concentration of the center with respect to the halo that thing started it. This particular model given in the book is a Plummer model, and it gives you some idea about how all this goes. That then effectively points the way towards the future. I mean, the system that we have then goes through the following number of phases. We had already seen in the previous lectures, that was like about lecture 5 or 6, that if you start with a spherical system overall, the very first thing that happens is a core bounce, that is to say, the stellar system contracts and you get a rebound of the stars from the center. And very similar, of course, to what you have if you just simply let a liquid mass just simply fall into itself and you get a rebound. So after that rebound, when you have a certain shell of stars trying to get out and another shell of stars going in, you get a relaxation process to here. So you have core bounce to begin with. Then you have a sort of relaxation process that does not go to completion. We have already seen the numbers. That simply would take too long. And then finally you have core collapse What happens next is relatively complex. In the book, there is a chapter 754 on what happens after core collapse, and a numerical solution of what might happen you will find in figure 7.6 when you see that in the core, after this time here, you basically go back to a phenomenon that is similar to what we had all the way in the beginning. So this core, after collapse, then starts to act like a mini-initial stellar system, which then again goes through a core bounce. It turns out then that because the core, after core collapse, is so very strongly gravitationally bound, that the wave, as it were, the wave sort of given to the system over here that propagates outward, stays closely into the center, which means that you, rather than getting a single core bounce, you get an oscillation effect, right? These are known as gravothermal oscillations. Gravothermal oscillations. And it is at this stage that the theoretical models sort of detach themselves from physical reality. Because in those cases, other effects, such as the mass distribution or the mass redistribution of stars, stellar evolution effects, etc., etc., will start to play a role. So it is approximately here that we have to stop talking about stellar dynamics as such, because after that point, other effects, other physical effects, certainly start to play a role. One of those effects is external. Because the timescales here being so long, you may have wondered why I didn't start talking about the neighbors. I mean, after all, we know from cosmology that stellar systems are not isolated in space. They have neighbors, and the characteristic encounter timescale there is, at the present stage of the universe, something of the order of a billion years or thereabouts. I mean, within a billion years, our galaxy, for instance, is going to be hit face-on by the Andromeda Nebula. That means, then, that on a timescale that is very, very many relaxation timescales, one is no longer justified in considering a stellar system as isolated. And therefore, even though from an intellectual point of view it may be interesting to compute what happens, from an astrophysical and a practical point of view, this no longer makes very much sense. Having said that, that mostly means that we have thereby reached the end of the road of our discussion of stellar dynamics. What I should like to do is end this with a small computer demonstration of precisely this series of effects on a Plummer model, which is effectively the same as what I have shown to you early, all the way at the beginning of the lecture series. And so I'd like to come back full circle there, demonstrate this to you, and sort of give a running commentary of what it is that is going on in front of our eyes.